Hello and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me a bit later today will be Tim Phillips. He will be joining us for the review, and that will be revealed in a second. We are broadcasting semi-live again from our homes, as I don't know, by the time this episode comes out, maybe we'll hear about when Stage 3 will begin, and maybe when we can start recording these things in person in studio again. I would certainly enjoy the air-conditioned comfort of the CFRU studios in exchange for shutting off all of my fans in order to record things. But hey, that's part of the fun and challenge of recording in these pandemic times. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans, and we are here every Wednesday at 3 p.m. for the time being to talk about the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new comedy drama Brittany Runs a Marathon, which you can now stream anytime you so wish on Amazon Prime streaming video. So, typically, on a typical show, when we're typically recording in typical times, we spend the first half talking about the news. And that's what we're going to do with the first half of this week's show. Or the first part, I guess I should say. It's not technically half. Anyway, I'm going to go through some of the recent news items that have been making the news and we've been looking at and chatting about as we go through these COVID times. The simplest one, I guess, is the one we'll start from first. It's like, when will we get back into theaters? Well, last week, I think, or the week before that, it was recently anyway, it was announced that Tenet is moving to August 14th to be released that weekend. August 12th, technically, it's opening on the Wednesday, but it'll be for that August 14th weekend, which was recently vacated by Wonder Woman. Warner Brothers moved Wonder Woman back to the first weekend in October, and a lot of people thought this might have been in preparation for moving Tenet, and it so was. So Tenet is now going to open on that weekend, August the 14th. Mulan, which was going to open the week before that, is now going to open on the August 21st weekend. Analysts are still kind of, shall we say, unsure that that's what's going to end up happening anyway, because it could be that, you know, with COVID running amok with 50,000 new cases every day in the United States, it could take even longer for the United States to decide it's safe enough to open the movie theaters again. Some states have stalled their reopening plans. Others have actually rolled them back and started closing things up again. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in terms of, by the time we get to this point in August, whether we'll be hearing again them pushing back Tenet again. Because as we've discussed before, there's no way that movie is opening unless they can be assured they're going to be able to maximize theatrical attendance. In the meantime, all we have left is the drive-in theaters, and it's interesting to see that business coming back. 104 out of the top 135 highest-grossing movie theaters in North America last weekend were the drive-ins. And what were the big hits? The box office hits at the drive-ins in the movie theaters last weekend? Well, it was Zootopia, The Avengers, and Jurassic Park. Zootopia made $280,000. The Avengers made $260,000. And Jurassic Park made a little less than that. So that's good news for these movies that are 5, 10, 30 years old almost. That they are still raking in the bucks. But, I mean, that's what this is going to look like in the immediate future. Is that, you know, as movie theaters reopen, as some start to reopen, what are they going to be playing? Well, they're going to be playing a lot of stuff that came out earlier this year. Bad Boys for Life, Bloodshot, Invisible Man, Onward. Things that have already been, you know, frankly, released on VOD since. But that's going to be the game, is that theaters are going to open. The pickings will be slim until more theaters are able to open and studios feel comfortable releasing those big movies. Speaking of theatrical reopenings, New Brunswick has reopened some of their theaters. As you may know, COVID-19 has hit the theaters in the Maritimes, with a little less severity. They now have a bubble in the four Maritime provinces where they're able to travel around inside the four Maritime provinces. But in the theaters, though, it's going to be 60 to 80% less capacity. So if you go to the theaters in the Maritimes, or in New Brunswick, I should say specifically, the maximum capacity is going to be about less than half. And in some places, it may even be less than a quarter. Movie theaters, Landmark Cinema has reopened their theaters in BC, Saskatchewan, and Alberta to reduced capacity. 8 of the 24 Cineplex theaters in BC have been opened, so a third of their theaters have been reopened. They're offering $5 admission, so considerably cheaper. $2.99 on Cheap Tuesdays, which is even more of a steal. When the theaters are going to open in Ontario is a question. It's going to come with Phase 3 announcement, likely. When that's going to happen, we're not sure. Premier Doug Ford talked about that last week. But there's been no firm dates yet. In other theater news, there is this interesting story from last week. Cineplex has filed suit against Cineworld. Now, Cineworld is this big UK chain. Cineworld is this big UK chain that was going to buy out Cineplex, and that deal came to an end. Allegedly because of COVID-19. I'm going to read a bit from the Cineplex statement. Cineplex claims that Cineworld breached its contractual obligations and its duty of good faith and honesty in contractual performance. Cineworld purports to rely upon alleged adverse impacts. I hate these legalese statements. Alleged adverse impacts of COVID-19 on Cineplex's business to terminate the arrangement, which it is not entitled to do. The contractual agreements between the parties expressly exclude outbreaks of illness, such as COVID-19, as a circumstance entitling Cineworld to terminate the agreement. So basically, Cineplex is arguing that Cineworld inappropriately and in bad faith pulled out of the agreement, basically blaming it on COVID-19, and Cineplex says that they were not allowed to do that. Cineplex is suing Cineworld for $2.18 billion. This is for lost costs having to do with like arranging the merger, the buyout, whatever you want to call it. Cineworld was going to buy up Cineplex for $34 a share, which sounds pretty good, but on Friday, the Friday at the end of last week, the Cineplex basically closed $8 a share, $8.50 a share on the Toronto Stock Exchange. So it was going to be a pretty good deal for Cineplex. I don't know if maybe those shares were higher pre-COVID, but still, I can't imagine that the shares of Cineplex were $34 a share right before the pandemic sort of closed everything down. So there's that to keep an eye on. Another thing to keep an eye on is when production might start again. Yes, we're looking at when theaters and things might open, but there's another big question about when studios and movie production will start up again. There was an article in the, I want to say, Hollywood Reporter, that here in Ontario, studios are technically allowed to be open as of the Stage 2 economic opening. However, these studios are having a hard time sort of getting the safety protocols in place and trying to figure out what that will look like. The person who heads Toronto Pinewood, which is like one of the biggest studios in Toronto and probably in Canada for that matter, but the head of Toronto Pinewood said that there likely won't be any significant production until Labor Day. Studio City, which is another big studio facility, says that it probably won't be until August 1st that they will see some action on... I wasn't planning on that pun. Anyway, they won't be seeing some action until after August 1st. Elsewhere, Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings, which is one of the big Marvel movies coming up, it will be looking to start production again in Australia sometime this month. Avatar 2, the Avatar sequels, have begun reshooting in New Zealand. Of course, Australia and New Zealand were both less hit, shall we say. They did not suffer as big as Canada and the U.S. in terms of the number of COVID-19 cases, and the governments there kind of shut them down really, really quickly. So they're able to move a bit more swiftly with a bit more forward momentum than studios here, and definitely in the United States, although studios were trying to make a move to start production before California got hit with more cases or an increased number of cases of COVID. What else can we talk about? How about the Toronto International Film Festival, which they announced kind of the first part of their programming last week. It is going to be a mix of at-home and in-person events. There's going to be like Q&As and talks that are going to be available online. There's going to be a variety of in-person films as well. They've released a couple of first selections, including Halle Berry's directorial debut, Bruised. Also Concrete Cowboy from Ricky Staub. Another Round with Thomas Vinterberg, who's the director there. And Ammonite from Francis Lee. They have arranged also for some very high-profile people to be ambassadors for the festival, including Ava DuVernay, Taika Waititi, Nicole Kidman, and Martin Scorsese. And things are still kind of in flux now, but it looks like there'll be at least 50 new feature films and special programming that are part of the festival. And in sort of other news, streaming is something we're going to have to get maybe a bit more used to in terms of how we see the new films. This week, SpongeBob, the sequel to the SpongeBob movie, was officially pulled from the schedule for later this year. They will be releasing instead on VOD sometime in the spring, next spring, I should say, 2021 spring. This fall is a very successful track by Trolls World Tour, which made $100 million in its first 3 weeks on VOD. And it's been considered a success. I think the final numbers in terms of how the VOD compares to the domestic box office, I think there was like a $6 million difference. So Universal is probably very, very pleased with how that turned out. We also learned this week that The Trial of Chicago 7, which is the new Aaron Sorkin movie about the very famous riots that happened at the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago, that is going to VOD, specifically Netflix. Netflix is going to be the primary distributor of that film. It was originally going to be released in theaters in the fall. Now it's going to go straight to Netflix and be distributed worldwide in much the same way as The Irishman and Marriage Story. It's going to be one of Netflix's big awards contenders. If there is going to be indeed an awards season this year, we'll have to wait and see. So that's interesting. One of the things analysts are warning there is piracy concerns. They noted a huge uptick in piracy of, especially of note of Bloodshot, the Vin Diesel comic book movie vehicle. So that's going to be one of the problems to solve going forward. Not that nobody has been working on trying to solve piracy all this time. And for the last news story, Ray Fisher, who played Cyborg in Justice League, retracted some previously nice things he said about Joss Whedon, who took over directing duties of Justice League. He posted on Twitter that he renounced those things he said in 2017 at Comic-Con and said that Whedon was gross, abusive, unprofessional, and completely unacceptable on the set of Justice League. That's kind of another black eye for Whedon. It's another black eye for Justice League, or at least his Justice League. We talked, I think it was last year, about the allegations about Joss Whedon being inappropriate with female fans and female co-workers. So this is not a great look for him, especially given those previous allegations. It also maybe reveals some of the things going on behind the scenes. Like, a lot of the actors in Justice League have been very much behind the Snyder Cut movement, which of course we now know is going to be released on HBO Max next year. But, you know, Gal Gadot, Jason Momoa, and Ben Affleck have also been all part of the quote-unquote release the Snyder Cut, hashtag release the Snyder Cut movement. And so maybe this explains why is that they had a very, like, Ray Fisher had a very negative experience working with Joss Whedon on Justice League. And of course, there could be a variety of reasons for that too, not to excuse anything that Joss Whedon has done, because that was a very high pressure situation where he basically had 6 months to throw together a movie that Warner Brothers had so much baking on. The movie had been changed about four or five times in the process, and I mean, I can't imagine that experience was fun for anyone, no matter how great the interpersonal dynamics were. Anyway, I think there's going to be a great book about what happened behind the scenes on Justice League sometime in the future. That's going to wrap up the news. I was thinking about this as, you know, we're trying to get things going. I don't think they need the promotion, but I'll just do a shout out here for the Mustang Drive-In, which is down Highway 7 on your way to Rockwood, just outside of Guelph. Tonight, Wednesday night, and Thursday night, they are playing the 1989 Batman and Bad Boys for Life, which came out earlier this year. And on this weekend, they are doing a fundraising screening for Guelph Black Heritage Society, who are co-presenting this weekend's program, which is going to be Ryan Coogler's Black Panther and Ava DuVernay's Selma. So that should be very much worth checking out. And if you do have a car, and if you're interested in going to the drive-thru, maybe for the first time, there is no better time, because that's the only action in town if you want to see things projected on the big screen. So I'll leave that there, and I will turn things over to the review after we take our musical break. We got Brittany Runs a Marathon, that review coming up. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca. Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
We have a bunch of membership options to fit all your fitness needs with rates as low as $129 a month.
I'm sorry, I thought you said as low and then the $129 for a month.
Yeah, that's a starting rate, $129 a month, and for that you get access to everything in the gym except half of it.
That's so every person we've walked by has $129 to just give to you. Is there a sliding scale for people in debt up to their tits? Okay. You do know that people can go outside, though, and just be outside and, like, do things.
Absolutely.
And that's the same fitness experience.
You know, you pay for our facilities.
But going for a run outside, that is zero. And then this one is, what is it again?
And that was a clip from Brittany Runs a Marathon. It's the new film from writer-director Paul Downs Colizzo, and it stars Gillian Bell, Mykela Watkins, Utkarsh Umbudker, Lil Ray Howard, Misha Stock, and Alice Lee. I am now being joined on the line by resident running marathon expert Tim Phillips. Tim, how are you today?
Doing well. Just finished a 5K back home. Ready to do end credits now. Yeah.
Very cool. Very cool. We were talking before we started recording about going out on walks in these times, but yeah, I think that's about as athletic as I get. I don't know about you.
Yeah, same for me. I'm not a runner.
Okay.
whenever I've tried to run, I run, and then I'm like, oh my god, I'm running. I freak out. I'm like, oh man, I'm gonna pass out. Yeah, much prefer to walk. That's for sure. I like speed walking, but running, not mm-hmm. for me.
All right, good. Now that we've established our bona fides, let's talk about Brittany Runs a Marathon, which is streaming on Amazon. And this was your pick, Tim. So what attracted you to watching Brittany Runs a Marathon as a noted non-runner like yourself?
Well, I wanted to pick up some tips so I could get into shape. I figured fictional characters are the best way to learn how to improve your fitness. Mm. But I saw it on Amazon Prime. There's a lot of advertising. We discussed this before. You'd seen the ads as well. It looked like a good comedy, a sort of a self-improvement comedy. I was thinking probably a la Trainwreck or something like that. So caught my eye, and I said, hey, let's watch this. This looks good. It's a feature-length film, comedy. It could have some laughs and tell a deeper story. So,
The advertising on Amazon Prime is certainly notable, especially if you're like binge-watching something like I've been lately. Amazon Prime has all 8 seasons of The Vampire Diaries, and I've been watching that through. And they kind of have the same 12 ads on a loop at the end, so they play an ad between episodes. And one of them is Brittany Runs a Marathon, so I've probably seen that ad at least a dozen times, along with ads for Homecoming, 7500, what else? Man in the High Castle. Just, you know, it kind of get bombarded with the same stuff. You know, it's Amazon's annoying, even more annoying version of the Netflix thing. It comes up at the end of the thing you're watching on Netflix, but I digress. because you kind of get bombarded by something. Yeah, even if it's something you may not typically seek out, you kind of get it in your head that you have to watch it. And I think that's what happened with Brittany Runs a Marathon, at least for me, which is why when you suggested it, I thought, yeah, sure, why not? But having said that, I'm glad to have had the opportunity to watch it. It was actually the audience winner at Sundance last year. I don't know if you knew that. Yeah, so it won the audience prize. It kind of goes against the typical image of Sundance movies, which are typically like big, pretentious sort of dramas. What I like to call sad bastard movies like Manchester by the Sea. So it's kind of antithetical to that. But at the same time, I was kind of drawn in by, I don't want to say unconventional because that sounds kind of blah, kind of, you know, not what it's getting at. But it is sort of taking this core idea, which is at the heart of a lot of these comedies, especially female-driven comedies, where the point is that the woman has to change. There is a demand upon her by society, by a romantic interest or whatever, that she must change. And then there's a montage that's a couple of minutes long, and voila, she's changed, and life is automatically better. And Brittany Runs a Marathon kind of takes that like kind of two-minute idea, stretches it out over a movie, and then says, actually, when you change things, or when you change this one thing you think is holding you back, you don't actually radically alter your entire life. It's actually one small step in you know, creating bigger change in your own life. And the thing that you might think is your problem might not actually be your problem, and you only find that out when you make the point of changing that one thing, which in the case of Brittany Runs a Marathon is the titular character's weight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's always deeper than that, and the lead character, she goes to the doctor and he tells her you have to lose weight, and she's a hard partier, she's taking Adderall, overindulging all the time, partying, and that's the point where she knows she has to make a change in her life, and then she starts working hard at it. It is a formula we've seen before, but I think sort of the charm of the lead character played by Jillian Bell, there's some realism there too with her starting to run, joining this runners group and being at the back of the pack with her new running buddy who also can't run very well, Seth. you can see like this conceivably could happen in real life, right? Somebody is trying to get in shape. They join this group. They're not very good, but they make friends with the other person who can't run very well. And they form a bond and go from there. And then also, like you were saying, Brittany thinks, oh, she makes this one change, her life's going to be a lot better. And then she sees other people's lives as being perfect. Like there's Catherine, her neighbor, who's also in the running group, who she thinks has the perfect life. But then when you peel back the layers, she's going through a nasty divorce. She has a lot of problems. So it's kind of like, especially in the social media world where you're sort of like looking at people and saying, oh, they're living the perfect life. You see on Instagram these pictures of them, you know, out on vacation or running a marathon or what have you. And you think, oh, they have the perfect life. But really, really, it always goes deeper than that. So I think the movie did draw upon that, and that there are deeper issues than just weight for this character. I think it does a good job at it. It's just, it's not like, it is to me formulaic, but in a good way. Like you can see what's coming, you know what's about to happen in a lot of senses. There's a couple surprises here and there. But I think it tells a good message, a good underdog story. But it does follow the conventions you'd expect from such a story. So I don't think you're getting extremely deep with the character, but you're seeing that, okay, there are other issues she's dealing with, and it's not just a weight loss problem. It's a whole sort of lifestyle that she has to change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the social media aspect of it that you mentioned is interesting too, because I think the film does a really good job of unpacking some of that millennial angst. You know, you have Brittany who's, you know, looking on social media and seeing people lead the best version of themselves, and seeing, you know, everybody she follows, they're getting ahead in their career, they're getting ahead in their lives with romance or with children, and that's a really hard measuring stick to measure yourself against. And of course, as you mentioned, you know, social media hyperinflates things, and we see this in her roommate Gretchen, who is kind of obsessed with her followers and being an influencer. And she's at one point, Brittany's watching this video of her on a rooftop with her boyfriend drinking champagne first thing in the morning. And you have to realize that on some level, as this woman's roommate, Brittany understands the artifice of this, the performative aspect of this, that they probably just went up to their own apartment building's roof to film this. That there really isn't any, like, she isn't living this glamorous lifestyle because they live in the same kind of crappy hole in the wall apartment in New York City. Yeah. But she's looking at that with this degree of just like contempt mixed with jealousy, and it's you know, it's really hard for her to overcome that, even though at some level she has to understand how fake, you know, that it is entirely fake, because she lives with this woman and they have very, very similar lives in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it shows sort of like the artifice, like you're saying, of social media, and then you can get to what's really important in life, and that's, I think the movie does a good job showing Brittany, seeing, you know, what's really important to her, what relationships are important to her, and which are not, and, you know, the one with the roommate is sort of a destructive relationship, because she's a sort of a negative influence who encourages her to self-destruct by partying all the time, who is posting on Instagram these unrealistic pictures that make Brittany at the same jealous and sort of angry, knowing that, you know, we're living the same life. This is just totally phony what's being put on social media. So I think that's an interesting component of it. It's definitely not the main, I don't think it's really the main crux of the film, but it's definitely an interesting aspect of the film.
No, and it is part of sort of the whole knot that I guess Brittany sort of tied herself up in. You know, the outer appearance, like her thing for going running, her desire to start running, it comes out of like a visit to the doctor who says to her, you know, you have to lose a bit of weight. Well, maybe not a bit. He has to lose like 50 pounds or something. But, you know, it comes out of, you know, this idea that she has to get a bit healthier. She has to quit partying so hard, as you mentioned. Otherwise, it could lead to more serious health issues in the future. And it then becomes, as she sort of sees the positive effects of this, what starts out as a bit of a mission to improve self-health ends up becoming a thing where she improves her outer self as well, and all of a sudden people will hold the door for her on the subway. And, you know, people who she has known for, you know, presumably for months or years start to notice her and in a way that is different from how she's been treated and how she's come to see herself, which is the funny fat sidekick. And then you see that as the movie progresses, it becomes this all other hang up, right? Where she isn't just running to be healthy. She isn't just running as like a way to improve and to better her life. It becomes her identity because, all these new positive things have come from it. And it's interesting to watch something that, you know, it tries to improve your life, or something you've used to improve your life ends up becoming a monster that you feed and ends up becoming this negative influence again. And of course, you know, what it is a lesson in, as with a lot of things, a lesson in moderation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And she learns, you know, what's important to her, what relationships. I really liked her relationship with the fellow pet sitter, Jern. So she gets a job as a pet sitter for this family, and turns out there's this other pet sitter, Jern, who's living in the house. And I thought he was really funny, and I really liked their relationship. Yeah, I thought, you know, this added some good comedic elements to it. Because overall, I felt the movie worked well as sort of as a dramedy, and there was some realism to it that you don't see in a lot of dramedies. Because I compare it to Trainwreck, because I felt there were similar components to Trainwreck. But watching Trainwreck, I really liked how the absurdity of certain characters, right? You know, like Bill Hader's character or John Cena's character. So I think Jern added some comedy to it. And also, obviously, Jillian Bell in the lead role, very comedic. Because otherwise, it could have played as just a straight drama, really, like with her interactions with the other characters. I liked that. I like that relationship. I like the quirkiness of it. And yeah, adding some more laughs to it, because, like I was saying, it is definitely a dramedy. It's got some really funny moments, but, you know, I wasn't like laughing out loud a whole lot or anything like that. It's very sort of natural movie, which is good. There's pros and cons to that. I think it's more authentic than some other films, like maybe Trainwreck or other like Judd Apatow films. But at the same time, I kind of missed some of the absurd humor you get in some other films, right? I think it could have used maybe a few more absurd laughs or another character, quirky character or something.
It's interesting because I had like real laugh out loud moments in a couple of scenes. One of them is when she goes to interview for the babysitting position, and it's clear she's like embellished her resume because she has not babysat for the Bidens, but or gone to Cornell. What makes me laugh is the part where the parent who she's being interviewed by gets out the baby doll and says, "Can you demonstrate on the doll, doing infant CPR?" And I was laughing out loud because I was thinking, how bad is this going to get? Because there is no way that this woman knows infant CPR. And, watching her kind of struggle through that, like, you know, listening to the doll and going, "Oh, she's not breathing. Oh, your baby's dead." And it just the deadpan nature of that, that made me laugh out loud. The humor is subjective and all that. I do like your comparison to Apatow, because I was thinking about King of Staten Island while watching this. Because I think it's King of Staten Island's another movie that captures kind of millennial angst. It's another movie where you have a comedian, in that case Pete Davidson, who's playing a bit more dramatic, like Jillian Bell. Jillian Bell is a comedian. Peter could probably rattle off her credits better than I could, but in terms of the King of Staten Island, it's very much about this sense of like listlessness and this sense of pie in the sky kind of thinking. In that movie, the Pete Davidson character wants to open a restaurant where you can get a tattoo at the same time, and that made me think of Jern's that bird poncho, his Kickstarter for the bird poncho. And you're thinking, both these ideas sound very much like someone who lives a lot on social media might come up with, but in terms of, like, practical reality, who's going to go to a restaurant to get a tattoo, who's going to wear a poncho with birds on it, especially when you're selling it as, like, business casual wear, it speaks to that in both films. Like, there's a very hard reality for each of those characters to realize that, dreams are important, having aspirations is nice, but, there's also a hard reality, too, that sometimes you have to sort of claw your way maybe that's not a whole great message either, that whole pull yourself up by your bootstraps, which is not entirely true as an ethos either, but, both films deal very much with how real reality is versus how we've sort of learned to process reality. Not that I'm speaking as a millennial, because I'm at least a couple of years out from that demographic, but yeah. I do feel like I understand that ethos a bit.
Yeah, and I actually looked up the writer-director of this, this film, and he's actually a playwright, screenwriter, and this was his directorial debut, and his plays, actually, one of his plays, most acclaimed, talked a lot about social media pressures and pressures for millennials. So that seems to be a theme that he's drawn to. And you can see that in here. Definitely, reality versus, you know, what's on social media and what you're projecting there. Definitely something he touches on here. I think he's, from what I read in some of his plays, he delves a lot deeper into that in a more dramatic context. But yeah, I think that's a good comparison with the Apatow film, sort of, you know, people aspiring, having these dreams, which it's great to have dreams, but like you said, there is a hard reality and there's work that has to be done to get to those dreams as well, right? So something I really liked about this is all, you know, the work she puts in, Brittany puts in to run the marathon, and there's a lot of good running scenes, and you see that she's working hard and it's not coming easy for her. And I would say for most of the film, I really like that. Near the end, I felt like things sort of fell into place a little too neatly, you know, or it was fast forwarded too much. You know, she has that one setback, and then now she's on track again to run, and she's, you know, she has this job in this advertising agency again. She's back on track, and you don't really see the struggles immediately before that. It seems like she's given a pep talk by her brother-in-law, right? She goes and visits her brother-in-law and sister in Philadelphia. He gives her an inspirational speech, and then all of a sudden she's back on track again, and it sort of fast forwards to her, you know, 1 year later, everything, you know, everything's seemingly on track for her again. So that's the thing. I liked up until that point, and then near the end, I did feel like it maybe was put together a little too neatly, but I really liked the running scenes. I really liked the marathon at the end, and I thought that was good in a true underdog movie sense. I really enjoyed that, and yeah, it really showed, you know, how much work and effort was put into this, and you know, nothing, like you said, nothing comes easy, and she overcame a number of obstacles to get to her goal, which you expect going in, but it's always fun to watch, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's I will say that too, it is a little padded. As Sideshow Bob once said, it's an ending so predictable it could have spewed from the power book of the laziest Hollywood hack. But on the other hand too, when your movie is called Brittany Runs a Marathon, you do want to see her run that marathon. And
they should have cut out all the running scenes. Yeah, that would get experimental with it.
Yeah, for sure. No, I did enjoy the as you said, the running scenes. I love the marathon scenes because they actually shot that during the New York City Marathon. Jillian Bell went out and ran. I read an interview with her where she said she ran about 3 miles total, and it's a 26-mile course. So she didn't run the whole thing. I mean, that would have been maybe a bit too Dogma 95 for Brittany Runs a Marathon. I loved the realism of that, being in the actual marathon, seeing all those runners, getting a taste of that energy. I think that let me forgive any sort of triteness in the ending too. And I also want to highlight Lil Rel Howery, who plays the brother-in-law. Who a lot of people might know from Get Out. He's the friend in Get Out to the TSA inspector, who does warn the main character about going to his girlfriend's parents' house.
Don't go there. Get out.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. He's ahead of the curve. And I think one of the best parts of that movie. And he was really good here. I enjoyed him. I was also thinking about, we kind of jumped over her too, but Michaela Watkins as Catherine, who Brittany and her friends dismiss early in the movie as quote unquote Moneybags Martha, because you know, she owns a studio, and she's a photographer, she's very well off, it seems. And then you're right, it's sort of revealed through the course of the film that, you know, not only has she had issues in her past with drugs and things, but she is in the middle of this ugly divorce that seems to be tied by to her taking a pain medicine, and her husband, you know, sort of. It's kind of not explicitly said that her drug problem was so bad that the husband was concerned that her taking a painkiller would force her to relapse, and he kind of overreacted, or she did something to cause, you know, in that. That's kind of left unclear. But I enjoyed that ambiguity a lot, and I really liked Michael O. Watkins. And one of the things that came out of that was, and it sort of felt into the whole theme of millennial angst, is that leads to Brittany to go on her spiral, is there's a scene where Brittany hasn't won the lottery to get into the marathon, although her friend did, and so she has to raise the money, and instead Catherine and Seth and Seth's husband sort of pool some money in and give it to Brittany so she can get in, and she kind of takes that badly. And that leads into the whole discussion she has with her brother-in-law later, where he's talking about, you know, you have all these people who are, like, pushing for you and wanting to help you up, and you kind of got to let them. You can't just push them away. And, you know, I think that's... There's a whole commentary in there about, like, the self-made man or woman, you know, getting a handout is bad. Anyone who wants to help you is charity, and charity equals a handout, and handouts are bad. And what the... I think the film makes, and maybe not intentionally, but, you know, it does make a compelling case that, you know, we've been told for years that, you know, the greatest virtue is being a self-made person and doing it yourself and all that. And community is, you know, having to lean on people is weakness. And I think that, you know, that it's an interesting commentary, even if it is subtle, that, you know, part of what sends Brittany off the proverbial wagon in terms of her new lifestyle regime is this idea that she has to do it on her own, and she can only depend on herself, even when people are trying to be kind to her and people are trying to support her. That may be a bit deeper than the filmmakers wanted to get, but that is something I kind of took out of it as well.
Yeah, she has sort of... She has this pride and sort of lack of trust too, and she thinks that she has to do it all on her own for sure. And it's tough to do anything, especially something as large as that, like running a marathon after not being able to run a block, like early in the film to get there. You need help, right? So it is a good sort of moment of epiphany for her when she realizes, and when Demetrius, her brother-in-law, is telling her, you got to let people in, you know. And that could be really if you look at a character study for her, like her big problem for her is not letting people in, probably like partying, going in a haze, and not really keeping relationships, you know, staying close to people. So that's an issue for that character. I think I agree with that. And, you know, they're not really delving that deeply into it, but you can see that's a problem for her. And that's why she can't, she's having trouble connecting her love life, with her career in a variety of different respects, because she's not really opening herself up to people, probably is a big part of it.
Yeah, letting the wrong people in, like her roommate, you know, kind of letting herself be used by the wrong people. And, you know, it's interesting to, you know, that Catherine and Seth, you know, they're giving as much as they're taking in this relationship with her. And there's the great scene where they agree to all try and enter the New York City Marathon, where they're equal parts psyching themselves up and trying to talk themselves out of doing it too. It's very, very different from other relationships we see Brittany has in the movie, especially with her roommate or her roommate's boyfriend. You know, the men at the parties who see her only as, you know, a means of instant gratification and not so much as potential relationship material, all this very short-term stuff that has nothing to do with sort of like the long-term work of actually bettering yourself and your life and finding people who aren't going to use you. And yeah, it's It's a surprisingly deep movie, I have to say.
The more we think about it, yeah.
No, it's, you know, one of the things I was thinking about was, do you remember the movie Run, Fat Boy, Run with Simon Pegg?
I've never seen that, no.
Oh, okay. I was thinking, obviously, because it's about somebody running a marathon who is, you know, overweight and trying to improve their lives, so they enter a marathon, obviously. And, it, you know, kind of on a surface level, kind of similar to Brittany runs a marathon. But, you know, in Run, Fat Boy, Run, it's very much more about the laughs. It's more of that quirky, you know, over-the-top comedy you were talking about. But one of the things I will say about Brittany Runs a Marathon, there is funny moments, as I've said. There's a lot of deep moments, as we've talked about. And one of the things I like is that the movie leaves it off with this idea that, again, because a lot of these movies, which is about, you know, transforming your life, the transformation is done and your life is perfect and it's happily ever after. And one of the things that Brittany Runs a Marathon leaves you with is that she ends by going out for a run, which, you know, says that, you know, this is a process. She's keeping it up. The transformation is not done. She's going to keep going. She's going to keep trying. And, you know, that's a great message to sort of leave it on, with this image of Brittany still running, even though she finished the marathon. She almost didn't, but then she pulled it out in the end in typical Hollywood fashion. She overcomes adversity, but at the same time, you know, it's not over, and she's still running. And I presume the real life Brittany, because there was a real life Brittany who inspired the tale, is also still running. And, yeah, I feel very life affirmed by the end of the film.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, that last scene where she goes out for a run again, she's still working at it. Because you're right, in so many films, it's like, oh, okay, you've lost the weight, you ran the marathon, and now it's time to celebrate. And, you know, yeah. It's not like going back to the process or the work that got you there. So it is good to see that. And it being based on a true Brittany, like you said, probably helps in keeping it, you know, closer to reality and the hard work that's necessary to do that than if it had been a completely fictional story. Like, I haven't seen Run, Fat Boy, Run, but if that was just an idea that came out of, like, writer's room and they're saying, okay, we're going to have this fat guy, he's going to run a marathon, he's going to have all these struggles, that's one thing. But I think, yeah, maybe that you, now that you mention it, having Brittany runs a marathon tied to a real person helps ground it into, you know, what were the important factors in her life and what kind of work did she have to do to get where she got and achieve her goals.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great cast. Well done film, well written, I think, well directed. I always enjoy authentic New York on film. And, you know, it kind of goes into areas you don't usually see on film, which I always enjoy. And, yeah, it's just all around fun. Sitting right there on Prime, and they keep hammering you over the head to watch it, so why not watch it?
I think they just stopped advertising. I don't know, I was on there. right after I watched it, they stopped advertising it. So you might have to search for it.
Well, that could be algorithms working. It's like, okay, yeah, you know, Tim finally watched it, so we can stop bothering him about it.
I hope so.
All right. So, Tim, now that you've done Amazon's bidding and finished watching Brittany Runs a Marathon, where can people find you on the internet?
Flash in the Deadpan on all social media. Yeah, check me out there.
And that's it for this week's show. We hope you liked it as always, and if you would like to listen to it again, you can find us on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. Download it on the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday over at Podbean, or you can get it through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. You can find us on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show and on Twitter at End Credits Radio. I will be back here on CFRU tomorrow at 5 p.m. for News and Politics on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. In the meantime, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can go to my political site at guelphpolitico.ca. If you'd like to read some of the things I've written about horror movies lately, you can go to Nightmare on Film Street, which you can find at nofspodcast.com. Stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We will be back next Wednesday at 3 p.m. for more end credits, and we will see you then.